Oof. Okay. Let me know when you're ready to go.
We can get started.
Take a minute.
Okay, ready.
Priya, hi. Welcome to Brand Game Strong.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
It's so great to have you. I must say, I was thinking about this on the way here, and I was thinking that in the last few years, I feel like we've seen such a, I guess, surge of like people on social media. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just don't know like the level of credibility somebody has because they have X number of followers or whatever. People automatically think, oh my gosh, yeah. You know, and I get asked a lot, like, who's your next big guest? And like all this stuff, and people are really excited. And in all honesty, within all of this, I have a science background, just like you, and I will talk about it.
Yeah.
I went to a science university, and whenever I hang out with my friends, who most of them are geniuses, and aren't on social media, I realize, yes, like it grounds me. And mm-hmm. I realize, yes, this is the stuff, like this is the stuff I like talking about. And that's why I'm so excited to have you, because I feel like, and I've never really been nervous, but today I'm nervous to talk to you.
That's so lovely to hear.
Because I feel like I'm just going to make a jumble of my words, but we'll just keep going.
Yeah.
Priya, I want to start by you telling us about your background, culturally, but also in terms of your career, what you do. And we're going to talk about your book, which I've got over here as well, mm-hmm. Motherland, which I'm just on the last leg of reading it. So really excited to discuss it with you. But yeah, tell us, who are you?
Okay. So I'm of British Indian origin. So my parents are from South India. And my husband's British Bangladeshi, and I've got a little girl, Leela. And I've been a science journalist for about 20 years now, I'd say. So I started out writing kind of science broadly, then I narrowed down into health. So I worked at places like The Lancet and the World Health Organization, but also like for newspapers like The Guardian and The Times. And I did that for quite a long time. And then I kind of kept having this pull to write about my upbringing, because I'd had this childhood where I went from England to India and then back again. And that was because journalists don't tend to examine their own lives that much. Mm. It took me a long, long time to really go, no, this is actually worth examination, because there's a whole other part of me that isn't the science writer, that isn't the scientist, that I wanted to talk about. And I have so many other friends who are British and another part of South Asia. Mm. And it felt like there would be maybe not the exact experience, but lots of points of connection.
Yeah.
And yeah, there really have been loads. Mm.
So interesting. While I was reading your book, I don't think you know this. I don't know if you know this, but I was born and brought up in Barcelona.
Were you?
Yes.
Oh.
And I have been following you on Instagram for a while. And anytime you're like posting something, I don't know, I always hold back, but I'm like, I want to tell her, like, you know, I'm in Barcelona and I'd love to meet her or whatever. But it's so strange that we're meeting in London.
Yeah.
But reading your book, there are so many parallels between my life and yours. I was also sent to India without my parents to live there with my grandparents. I was raised by my grandparents when I was three.
Mm-hmm.
And not for very long, for about 9 months, but very similarly to you, when I read your story about how kind of you went to India when you were really young, you wouldn't have had a say in it, really.
No, definitely.
And it's this thing that you might look back at thinking, oh my gosh, like, you know, it was only me out of the whole family that spent so much time in India.
Yeah.
And I had a very similar experience where my parents wanted to move back to India. Like, my dad's plan was to kind of move back. And then for whatever reason, that didn't happen. And I started school in Spain and I kind of moved back. And I always think, you know, it would have been so weird had all of that actually happened, you know, the things that my parents wanted to do back then. I would have been very different. I would have had very different ideas of my identity, mm-hmm. and a very different relationship with my roots. So I want to start off by asking you, and I know you've spoken about this in your book, so, you know, excuse me if you're like repeating yourself, but tell me what your experience was like with your Indian heritage, and do you see it differently now that you're an adult?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So when I moved over, well, I had a little period of living with my grandparents when I was only about 4 months old. I have no recollection of that. I was on a farm in Mangalore. Then when I went back again, I was eight and I was in Mangalore again, which is a very sleepy kind of fishing village south of Goa, for people who don't know India very well. And I was the foreigner there. I was the Firangi. So people kind of, although we looked the same, I had brown skin and black hair and, you know, similar facial features because that's where my parents were from. I was really clearly foreign and I had an English accent and it took me a while to kind of feel like I fit in. Mm. So we were there for 8 years in total. My parents and my sister joined me after a while. And I think towards the end, when I was maybe in my teens, I really did feel like I belonged. I had my group of friends and I was old enough to kind of like run around Bangalore. We'd moved to Bangalore by this point to run around the city by myself. And it really felt like, okay, this is like my town and my country. Then at 16, we moved back to England. So again, like I was completely thrown into this position of being a foreigner. Mm. And I then felt super Indian because I think the identity that you're not inhabiting can sometimes feel really sharp and acute. So then I felt like really Indian. Then I had an Indian accent by this time. So I was in Dartford in Kent, not the most welcoming place to immigrants back in this would have been the mid 90s. Mm. It was a really complex thing. It just felt like wherever I went, these two halves of me, one half was maybe not really welcome. Yeah. And so I did what lots of kids, immigrant kids do. I kind of assimilated in that I completely dropped my accent. And kids can do this like within days, I think. You know, they just they're chameleon like, they just change how they are. Mm. And I just really wanted to not forget India, but I think I just needed to compartmentalize and just park it because I think kids are also really good at survival. So you know exactly what you need to do. Mm. Then I went to university in London and there were more British Asians and Asians, as in who would like come over from India or Pakistan or wherever. So I felt also because London's so much more multicultural, I kind of felt a bit more at peace. But I think I just flip-flopped a lot like over the years. And I do remember in my 20s feeling particularly homesick and I would like get on a flight to India maybe like I think probably at that point once a year, sometimes with my parents, sometimes just by myself because I had loads of cousins still in India who was really close with. And it felt like it would just kind of like fill up this cup of something that I needed that I couldn't identify because in your 20s, you're still figuring out your own identity in so many other ways anyway. And then in my 30s, I think I thought I'd kind of got it. But then I became a mum in my late 30s, and then that kind of changed everything again because my daughter now wasn't going to have the same ethnic makeup as me. She's part British Indian and part British Bangladeshi and has grown up her entire life like in European countries. So it really was like in the way that my parents and I didn't have the same sort of approach to being Indian, I guess. Me and my daughter also have a slightly different inevitably, we feel differently about our identities. Mm. Yeah.
If you don't mind me asking, what is your mother tongue and what is the mother tongue of your partner?
So my mother tongue is Tulu. It's a it's a verbal non-written language. There is no script even really. Mm-hmm. And my husband's is Bengali.
Mm. I've always wondered this as kind of the generation that we belong to, which is, you know, we're a lot closer to our, I guess, Indian roots, but also have learned to, like you said, assimilate and adapt in the Western country that we've grown up in. Have you instilled, I guess, those languages in Leela, in your daughter? And have you thought about it actively?
So when I was growing up, because my parents were really conscious that they didn't want me to, at that time, I think this was, you know, the kind of like 70s, 80s, they didn't, it was thought that if you taught kids too many languages, they'd get confused. So they didn't speak to me in what is their mother tongue. So I really only grew up speaking English. Mm. When I then moved to India, I did learn it, but not ever really to speak fluently. So I understand it perfectly. But when I try and speak it sounds foreign. Mm. And my husband is fluent in Bengali, but because he has also a complicated relationship with Bangladesh and his family and all of that, he never really wanted to speak it to Leela, even though I really wanted him to. So we sort of have, we bring it into our lives with a few words that I guess are kind of common across lots of languages. So like when she goes to school in the morning, she has her food in a little dabba, which is a little container, or she puts on her chappals when she goes to the beach. And, you know, so those words, I think, are just part of our language anyway, or are the way we speak English when I'm speaking with my husband. Or my sister or whoever. And so there are those little words.
Mm.
And that's unfortunately as much as I can do. I wish I could speak more Tulu or more Kannada, more Hindi, you know, to her. And I wish he would speak Bengali. But then the thing is, language is so emotive and has such a connection with how you feel about your identity that I couldn't really force him to speak it to her when for him it didn't feel natural.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I'm not a mum, and reading this book made me think of how I might be as a future mum if and when I choose to have kids. And the big thing for me is language, because similarly to you, my mother tongue is Sindhi. And I don't really speak it very well at all. Like, I'll say a few words and I'll try and impress my grandma.
Yeah.
But honestly, my grandma's on WhatsApp and she'll like send me all these videos on YouTube about how like Sindhi's a dying language. And it is, actually. It's very much a kind of dying culture, and it's a shame. Now with the rise of social media, it's changing, because there are a lot of pages now like going back into teaching Sindhi and kind of trying to make it more relatable. But there's a certain amount of guilt and shame, and it's not just in the language, it's also in the cooking. Like, there's a lot of things that, you know, my maternal grandma passed away like 10 years ago. She was one of like the best cook that I've ever known, or whose food I've eaten. And I feel like a lot of that has kind of trickled down into my mum's cooking. I don't really cook that much, so I'm killing it single-handedly with my, you know, just lack of cooking. So there's a lot of shame that comes with that, because if and when I were to become a mum, what would I teach my kid about their culture, you know? And your book talks about that a lot, because I think you've gone through this whole, like, you know, thought process with it, and every single phase of your kind of parenting journey has been, oh, but what does this mean for, like, our culture, and what am I teaching my daughter? And I don't know, it's just like a warm hug reading that, and kind of like reassuring knowing that we're all a bit of a mess when it comes
to it. It is really complicated, isn't it? Because there are times, I mean, so I do cook. Well, my husband is a really good cook, and I tend to get really lazy and let him cook. But I have a similar feeling where, I mean, there are, like, I don't know if I cook super Mangalorean dishes. I do cook, like, fish curries, more or less the way my mum makes them, vegetable dishes and things. But it's, some of the other cooking is just way too involved. Like, it involves, like, mixers and grinders and, you know, and I just don't really have the time for it. But what I do is, in Barcelona, there's a South Indian dosa place. So I do take my kid there, so she knows and likes, and she knows what she likes and doesn't like between idlis and dosas and those, like, really South Indian foods.
Mm.
So that's sort of like my shortcut, I guess, because I'm not making those at home. But then, yeah, I mean, I do think about some of the dishes that my mum makes that I don't even know what the recipes are. And I do think I really should get those from her, you know, because time just goes on.
Yeah.
And there are recipes of her mum's that she regret, that my mum regrets not getting. And like you say, they just get lost in the kind of mists of time, and then they're never made again. And that just feels incredibly sad. So yeah, I'm going to make a mental note to put those together.
I'm making one right now. Because
yeah.
My next question was going to be, do you think it is something we should all actively do more, you know, try and retain our heritage? Or do we let it You know, do we let it fizzle out? Because it's going to fizzle anyway, to an extent.
I think, I mean, so through history and just through time in general, like human beings like keep what they want, what they really cherish.
Yeah.
And then they let other things go. Like, I mean, I was just watching Bridgerton and I was thinking, oh my God, could you imagine being in that time where women couldn't study and couldn't just had no autonomy over their lives? So I'm super happy that that has more, I mean, you know, the world's not perfect, but a lot of those things have been let go.
Yeah.
And I think, like, we can hold on to the essence of things through, and but also things need to evolve. So I don't know, like, would we want to keep cooking the exact same dishes in the exact same way with no outside influence? Because these dishes wouldn't have been cooked in the same way 300 years ago, let's say, because there would have been different ingredients. So I feel like picking, sort of cherry picking certain things and honoring our tradition that way is probably a good way to do it with love and not be too stressed about it.
Mm. And also maybe celebrating the, let's say, like the combination of cultures that we've grown up with, because it will be that, you know, the way that my mum makes traditional Indian food because she grew up in India in her formative years won't be the same way that I cook my Indian food, where I might want to infuse it with like some Spanish, you know, flavors or yeah. Mediterranean flavors. So is it that, you know, the way that we perceive our heritage is actually just going to evolve with time rather than dissipate? You know?
I think so. And also because, let's say, if you did have a kid, then your kid would have, like, your heritage that you're passing on is slightly altered and slightly different. So you do have Spanish influences as well. Mm. So I think, yeah, I think evolution is always a good thing. And I think being creative, especially with things like food, I think is always a good thing. Having said that, when I sometimes eat like really old-fashioned Mangalorean recipes, I love it because, I mean, I just don't get them very often, really.
What's your favorite thing that you grew up eating in Mangalore? Bangalore?
I would say dosas, probably. Dosas and like a masala dosa with like really spicy potatoes inside, yeah.
Is it the same in Chennai dosa?
It's not bad, you know. It's not bad. The chutney's a bit, but
my parents' favorite restaurant.
Yeah, it's really good.
I wanted to take it to your education because we touched on the fact that you're a science journalist. You studied genetics.
Yeah.
You mentioned this in your book. I want to talk about, you know, race and genetics, because actually that chapter was absolutely fascinating in your book. What actually spurred you on to study this subject?
So when I was at school, and I kind of thought I'd be going into the sciences, but I didn't really have a clear idea about what I was doing. So this was, it would have been like very early 90s, and molecular biology, so genetics essentially, was just taking off at that point. And it was a really new field. And the idea that we could sequence our genomes and from that be able to cure diseases or treat things or just understand how the human body works in with so much more clarity, I found really fascinating, because I thought studying something that people have been doing for like hundreds of years seemed really boring and dull.
Mm.
And science, I think if you love science, you always want to be going into something new and discovering something new. So that's what I then went on to study. But it didn't come about from, I didn't really think about race or how genetics had been co-opted by racists. I was just thinking, this is just like really cool. I'm going to learn so much. And it was kind of evolving as I was at university as well. So that was really exciting.
Mm. Going on to, yeah, firstly, I just want to say, like, again, another thing I found quite similar is like the sheer nerdiness in both of us, because I also grew up reading a lot of books and being really fascinated by science. Your chapter in this book where you talk about sort of race and genetics says something that I think most of us know, this stat that 99.9% of our DNA as all human beings is identical.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the racism come from? Where do the differences come from? How, knowing this fact and knowing it in so much detail because you've studied it, and also being aware of the kind of things that happen in the world, you know, the systemic oppression, the white yeah. supremacy, the racism that all of us have faced, you know, being of not a Caucasian skin tone, living in the West. How have you protected your mental health during this, you know, like learning journey and discovering journey, especially as a mother?
I think because, I mean, science as a whole, not just genetics, has always been corrupted and twisted by pretty much everyone else. So politicians who talk about, for example, during the pandemic, there was so much that scientists knew. There was so much information that was available really early on, and it wasn't communicated because there were other political interests at play. And so the kind of purity of the science, I feel like, has never really probably ever been at the forefront. It's always, it eventually does shine through. And a lot of, as we saw with the pandemic, ignorance just has such a huge role to play as well. Mm-hmm. So what I think I really found interesting is people who are sort of well-intentioned might think, oh, well, you know, people just don't know any different, or they're uneducated or whatever it is. I think actually sometimes people really do know that there isn't actually, I don't know how many people really believe some of the things that used to be and probably still are believed about different races having different intelligences and so on. I don't know. I'm not convinced that people genuinely believe that. I think it's just a tool of white supremacy, because you see the same with casteism in India.
Yes.
And different castes. And again, it's sort of this belief that, you know, paler skin is better than darker skin, but those paler skin people are still of a different skin tone to kind of pale skin people in Norway. So, you know, it's not really ever been about skin color. It's just been about oppression and finding some way, some kind of proxy by which to do that. And so it is incredibly depressing. But I kind of feel like that's how the world has always been. It's always taken science. And, you know, there used to be a time where people were measuring like the size of your parts of your skull to another part. And that proportion would apparently tell you something when actually it just tells you nothing. Mm. So it's kind of just, yeah, it's kind of twisting knowledge as however you can come about it, and then using that to oppress other people.
Do you think inherently as human beings, we are wired to see the differences within each other? Or are we more wired to see similarities, but we have been indoctrinated to see differences more?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think kind of going back to when we were more in tribes, you do want to know if someone is kind of with you or against you. So like, are they more like you? Or are they more unlike you, I guess? Mm. And initially, and we are animals who go on kind of surface cues, you know, kind of superficial cues, as it were.
Yeah.
So how someone looks, how they might talk, how they might move. So potentially you could say, okay, someone with a totally different skin color maybe looks really different. But I don't know. I don't know if there are like equivalents in like the rest of the animal kingdom. They don't seem to behave in this way. So, and you know, in that sense, in terms of like pattern recognition, how we look at visually now, how those our visual centers work, it is still quite similar to other animals. So, yeah, I think there's been that social, political kind of element that's been added onto it.
Mm. You know, it's interesting when we talk about racism, because yes, as you know, someone who is Indian, I've actually experienced definitely like microaggressions throughout life. That's, you know, pretty standard, I guess, for us. But I was once told, I was crossing the road in Shoreditch, and someone said to me, probably in a, you know, drunken state, go back home. And in my head, I was like, what, to Barcelona? Like, what do you mean? Yeah. And, you know, so there's one side of the spectrum, which is like, we all kind of inherently are sort of vigilant and always aware that someone may say something to mm-hmm. us, whether it's on the tube or just walking, whatever. And we're kind of ready to put our guard up. Our own community, you know, Indians, I can maybe say like South Asians as well, have probably read enough to know that this does happen. we're quite a racist bunch ourselves. And we talk about this idea of white supremacy. And sometimes I feel like our own people, you know, are sort of almost like supporting that idea and not challenging it. Maybe our generation now, the more that we read, the more that we become friends with people who are, you know, not the same race as us, we're starting to, you know, push back on the idea. But I think the older generations do very much inherently believe that, you know, white people are like something to aspire to, or, mm-hmm. you know, speaking English fluently means you're more educated, or, you know, there's so much racism towards Black people as well. How do we get to a point where we see our own hypocrisy?
I think younger generations, as you say, are starting to really see that and starting to be quite shocked by it, because, like, mm-hmm. maybe when we were younger, I mean, I feel like I noticed it, but the full significance of it didn't really land when I was a kid or when I was a teenager. And then when you're an adult and you understand the implications of racism, and then you understand what it must be like to be one of a handful of Black people, say, in India, and to have such racist abuse thrown at you, it is truly horrifying. And this is something I've thought about a lot, because when I've told white friends this, they are really surprised, because they're like, well, hang on, but how are brown people being racist against either other kind of communities of brown people or against Black people? Like, how does that work? And I think, I mean, ultimately, I don't know if you've read a book called Caste by Isabel Wilkerson. No. Really, really, really good book. And she connects racism with caste, and she just makes all these amazing parallels. And ultimately, and I think James Baldwin might have said something about this as well, ultimately, oppression and racism, or casteism, it is all about power. Yeah. So it really is trying to kind of elevate yourself and your standing by kind of putting someone else down. And if that person is in an already oppressed, marginalized group, it is easy to do. And I mean, it's truly disgusting, but it is easy to do. And that's where I think it comes from, because it's not like a lot of people in India don't see the solidarity between them and, say, someone in an African country. They just kind of think, oh, no, that's them over there. This is us over here, and we're so different. It is mind-boggling how much racism there is across South Asia, truly.
Yeah, and it's the remnants of colonialism, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think many people just aren't acutely aware of the fact that it's inherent in all of us, including probably you and I, who are trying to unlearn a lot of that. Because there's only, you know, I guess when you're growing up, you are constantly bombarded with these ideals from all around you, especially from your own community, from people who've not taken a step to actually question their own beliefs, and they just kind of project, because also maybe they've been in survival mode and they've not had the opportunity to take a step back and really think. But it does baffle me, and it's hard having those conversations, I think, with loved ones, because you love them so much, you don't want them to feel negatively about, you know, like how they're behaving, or you know, you don't want them to think that you don't respect them anymore. But it is truly hard when you feel like you know something more and you should kind of say something when it's, you know, when there's something that's not right that's happening. And a lot of those conversations happened right during the pandemic, when we were all in lockdown, and the George Floyd thing happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much of a difference it's made. Do you think it has?
In South Asian communities, mm-hmm. you mean? That's interesting. I don't know, honestly, because I feel a bit more, well, I haven't seen, for example, any of my family in India since the beginning of the pandemic. Mm. I will be traveling there at the end of this year, so I can keep you posted.
Ooh. Yes, please do.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see how, what their response is. Although I do remember the last time I was there, it was just before the elections in the US, and I did have relatives, maybe only one, I think, who did actually want Trump to win.
Mm.
And That was really difficult. And I did have kind of not an argument, but like a really heated discussion going, do you actually know anything about him? You just voting for him because he's a man, or not voting for him because they're in India, but, you know, supporting him because he's a man or a white man. Like, what is it?
Or because he was on The Apprentice, like, because he's a celebrity.
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah.
Swiftly moving on to your book and on to, I guess, more positive topics. Motherhood. It's been the overarching theme of your book and something that I feel like many will resonate with, because there are a lot of feelings that you've very eloquently described in this book, and very humbly, might I add, that probably give maybe comfort to a lot of parents who maybe don't understand like how to approach conscious parenting, mm-hmm. How to dissect the different areas of parenting and kind of deal with certain unexpected scenarios. I think you described parenting as, it's very interestingly, where it was kind of like you're very much thrown into the deep end every second, like you don't know what's going to happen. It's this like cute little thing that you've made, but then you also like, you know, it makes you question so much about yourself. I wanted to ask you, firstly, how did becoming a mum to Leela change your own perception of parenting? Because I know you talk about there were things that maybe you grew up with that you were rejecting or saying that, no, I don't want to be like that as a parent. What have you found yourself mirroring in the way that your mum's raised you, maybe, and mm-hmm. your dad? And is there something you've not mentioned in the book that since you've written it, you've thought, oh, maybe I should have put that in, but, you know, it didn't quite make it into the final copy? A few questions there.
So how did it change my idea of parenting? I think I didn't quite know how I was going to take to parenting, because all that people had told me was, oh, it's nothing like you. It's unlike anything you have ever experienced. And I was like, okay, that's still not really, you know. I didn't know if I would be exactly like my mom or whether I'd be the complete opposite. And I had kind of intentionally, I guess, wanted to be somewhere between the two. I think my mom overall has been a really great mom. And so there are lots of things I wanted to keep. But then there are also other things that perhaps generationally I didn't really agree with, in terms of things like, you know, just being told to do things and no explanation and just being really quite strict about stuff. And, you know, I think maybe I thought I'd be like really fun and cool. And actually, I don't think I am. I think maybe the difference with, say, me and my mum is that I'll go back to something that I thought was really unexpected. I didn't expect to have as much fun as I do with my kid, because she's really fun, really great company. And we have great chats as we're going, like walking to school in the morning or I pick her up. And I didn't really expect that, because I don't think anyone had told me, or if they had, I wasn't really listening. I must have been paying attention to something else, some other aspect of motherhood. I've only got one kid. I've got two older stepkids, but they were older anyway. They weren't babies when they came into my life. So I've kind of only got the experience of day-to-day parenting with Leela. I didn't really expect for her to like make me laugh as often as she does. And that's like a huge bonus. I am, I think, maybe more strict than I thought I would be. Mm. Because I kind of saw that actually kids do respond to boundaries, like I think all human beings do, actually. They do like to know where they stand. They do like to know what's going on. And so where I differ from, like, say, my mum or my aunties is I will try, and my husband does this as well, like we try and explain things to her as much as we can so she knows what's going on, like what's coming up in the week even. I don't know if we always get it right. And then the thing is that sometimes you tell a kid something and then they've got like 1,000 other questions. So sometimes I don't really have time to say we're going here on Saturday and then spend half an hour like answering stuff about it. So I have to just shut it down. And yeah, it's been quite a ride. It's been great overall. And I feel like I'm also evolving, like with every year of being a mom, because she's evolving too. Like each age brings new things and new understandings, and her kind of understanding of the world has really changed year or not even year on year, but like 6 months at a time, it changes. So I then have to change in how I talk to her about things, or yeah, it does keep me on my toes.
It sounds like quite the roller coaster.
Yeah, I think it can be. And I think the thing is that, like, kids, when they're young, so Leela's about to turn 9, every few months their brains are going through this like whole new phase of development, and all of these new synapses are kind of being created. So there's a lot going on for kids. So I think probably the thing that tests me the most is trying to be patient, like, at all times. Even when, you know, she's really frustrating me, or she's frustrated and she can't articulate it, I think trying to be patient is probably a skill I've maybe developed that I don't think I had. I don't think I was super patient before I became a mum. Mm. But I've kind of had to be, because otherwise it's just me losing my temper or shouting, which I really don't like. Mm. And it's not fun for her either. Mm. So, yeah, it's very up and down, I'd say, with kids.
And going to the last bit of that question, which was, is there anything that you've not mentioned in the book that you wish you had mentioned now, or anything that maybe springs to mind that, you know, in hindsight, you'd like to add?
I feel like maybe there are things about how I have conversations with Leela that I think I touched on a little bit in the book, but maybe not as much. And so these are like conversations about, they could be things like, really kind of big weighty things like race and racism and identity. And those are some of the things I talk about in the book. But there are also things like, because she's a girl, I've talked to her about periods, and
yeah,
I've talked to her about, like, in a couple of years, I think in Spain, it's probably mandatory that they get the HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
Those sorts of things. And also, again, although kids in general are at risk of things like disordered eating, girls are much higher risk. So I've had to sort of try and broach things like that. And the way that I've done that is, I had no role model really for doing this, because my mum either kind of wasn't with me, or just, we just didn't talk about stuff like that. Like, I mean, my period chat with my mum was, I think, like a minute long. That was it. That was like one chat. And so, and not because, like, she's pretty open. It wasn't like a cultural thing. I think it was just her not really understanding or realizing maybe what information I needed, because she didn't get much at all.
Yeah.
So she thought, like, compared to her, like, childhood, she was doing great. And she was. But like with Leela, especially because I have a science background, I kind of explain things to her like a bit more, like what is actually happening in the body, which maybe not like every parent wants to do. But like for me, that's my natural kind of way about of talking about these things, I guess, is to, because kids are super curious, especially about the human body.
Of course.
And they really want to know, like, why do you bleed when you have a period? It sounds so wild and insane to a kid, but actually, if you explain it, they do kind of get it.
Yeah, it takes me back to when I had my first period, and it didn't really look like the way that they showed it in science class, and
where it was blue probably
like in the adverts. I didn't have a single conversation with my mum. I don't remember having one about periods, or I don't remember her sitting me down. And I think it was also because, like you said, I don't think she had that conversation with her mum. And she also had a sister. And so maybe like between them, they figured it out. But I had absolutely nobody to talk to about it. So I was very confused the first time it happened. I was like, is this meant to be my period? I'm not really sure, because it doesn't. Yeah, I don't know. And then there was a lot of shame involved, a lot of like skirting around the edges. Like, how do I tell my mom this? I remember very vividly. So I would see my mom buy pads. And in Spain, they have this thing called alas, right? The wings.
Yeah.
And I thought it was some sort of like cool thing. I was like, what are these wings you're buying? Like, what are you doing? Is it like a fairy? I don't know. And my mom always laughs at that, because she's like, yeah, you had no idea. And I'm like, well, you didn't help either.
Yeah.
How did you have the periods chat with Leela?
So I think I probably started talking to her maybe about a year ago, because I think, So the school she goes to is really small. So she knows like girls from younger classes and older ones quite well as well. And there's a girl like maybe about a year or so older than her, the only one in her class who had started her period. So I thought this was like a good way to kind of talk about it. So, and also she'd seen me buying tampons and stuff like that and had been really curious to know what they were. So I started off just literally explaining that, you know, once a month, if your baby, I said, your body tries to make like a hotel for a baby. And if no one comes to that hotel, then, you know, it has to just be chucked away and made again. And she was like, okay. And then like, you know, because kids can only take in like so much information at one time. And then like, as I've kind of like gone on, I've explained things to her that, so she knows more, I mean, I don't know, knows. She knows that there's like an egg and a sperm and they come together and start making the beginning of the baby. But I've told her things like that all the eggs that a girl has, she has them when she is a baby. So inside her mother, so like the egg that made Leela was actually inside me, inside my mum, like this Russian doll kind of thing. And that I just try and like pick on bits of information like that that she would find really interesting, which are scientifically accurate, but also, I mean, because I'm also a nerd, like you, I find it really fascinating. Yeah. And so, yeah, things like that. And then the other day I remember saying to her, because when I was pregnant, I had this NHS app that would say things like, now your baby's the size of a chia seed. Now it's the size of a blueberry. And then it goes on and she's like, why is it always food? And I was like, I don't know. It just always was. So I kind of like just like talking to and like it will be really random that it comes up. For me, that's the best way, because then it isn't like, okay, now we're going to have a chat and then kid doesn't really know like what's coming. It just feels very intense. Yeah, so I just drop it into conversations here and there.
Love that. I think that's kind of going to be like a good kind of blueprint example for new mums.
Yeah.
You talk about Elsa Braidgate. Can you explain to us what Leela said in that supermarket to you and how it made you feel? I also want to know, do you actually think Leela deeps her kind of like wide array of backgrounds that she's been exposed to as much as you deep it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So Elsa Braidgate happened. This was about 4 or 5 years ago, I think, when Frozen had come out maybe a few months before, and it was huge. And we watched it on repeat pretty much every day. So she was obsessed with Elsa, the main heroine of this film, who has this like massive long braid, blonde. And we were in Carrefour, and she just picked up, there's all this like little, a kind of little area with like kids kind of merchandising, and she picks it up and she says, oh, mum, I really, really want this. And I said, well, yeah, but it was meant to be like attached to your own hair. And Leela had jet black hair. And I said, but isn't it going to look a little bit odd? And she said, well, why would it look odd? And I said, well, you know, this is like for people who look like Elsa, I guess. And then she said, you know, well, I actually really want blonde hair. And I said, well, do you want to dye your hair blonde? Then she said, no, I actually want my skin to be peach, my hair to be blonde. And for her, peach was basically saying white. And so that was like the first kind of like moment where I'd ever heard her express anything like that. But that age, I've heard from friends who've told me that their kids, when they expressed anything like that, was around that age, because that's the age where kids kind of like their consciousness sort of expands to beyond just them. And then they start to see themselves in relation to like other kids, or like, or to other sort of personas that they see in music videos or TV or their dolls that they buy. So she was starting to have this understanding that her skin wasn't like these kind of beautiful sort of characters that she was really, that she really admired. And so I guess it was like for her a really simple thing of going, oh, well, her skin's white, so that's what I want to look like then.
Yeah.
But for me, it struck really deep, and it really was like so, yeah, it really wounded me, because I thought that I'd obviously done like a really poor job of raising her to have a good self-image of herself and, you know, to have self-esteem. And so then I thought, okay, I kind of need to course correct here. And so then started showing her Disney films that had like Aladdin, for example, or Mulan, who had princesses still, which I don't know if I fully agree with the Disney model, but, you know, they looked different. They looked a little more like Leela, or a little bit closer, I guess, to her skin color. And then brought dolls that were brown or black, and then brought books. And so everything that at the age of about five she was being exposed to, I tried to make it as diverse as possible. And it wasn't like we chucked away all her stuff that she loved or that she stopped watching Frozen. I just brought in the other stuff as well, because I do think like the diversity of it is important. I don't think you can be exclusionary one way or another. Yeah, and then we started talking to her about a bit more about India and a bit more about Bangladesh. And and so the culmination of all of that is then taking her to India this year.
Exciting times. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to like hearing from you what her experience is like and what it is like for you as well, you know, in a post-COVID world. And you'd think we'd all be more just, I don't want to use the W word, but woke.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I watched The Little Mermaid last week and the protagonist is black. I think Halle Bailey is the name. And a lot of people were furious when they realized Ariel was black. I thought it was so cool.
I was like,
gosh, you know, I cried so much in that film. Like, not only because it was so nostalgic and, you know, the music and everything, but it genuinely, there were so many moments where I was just like, wow, like I'm actually witnessing this. You know, it's pretty cool. And in a world of, you know, Princess and the Frog, and you've got Never Have I Ever and all these shows that are, you know, trying to be mainstream, I wouldn't say they're as mainstream as, say, like a Frozen, where you have, like, you know, Elsa and Anna, who are both white. I really hope that it does evolve with time. You did mention, though, in the book that kind of Leela sort of, you know, isn't always maybe aware of the fact that, you know, this of the maybe the implications of being brown living in Spain, because I, like you, have spent a lot of time in Barcelona and I know what it's like in terms of representation. Like, the only sort of South Asian faces you really see around you are the people that are selling mojitos on the beach, or it's people who run the corner shops, you know, or it's people who run the tourist shops on Las Ramblas. Half of them are my community or my cousins. Yeah. Yeah. And in a world like that, it's actually the only sort of South Asian people I interact with in Barcelona that are strangers are people trying to sell me something or like creepy men.
Mm-hmm.
One man once played Kuch Kuch Hota Hai while I was in Plaza Catalunya waiting for the metro. And just like he was 2 meters away and he just saw me and he started
so
playing.
So uncomfortable.
It. Yeah. And that I've grown up with that. Yeah. And I've grown up feeling like I'm not good enough. Like I'm not cool enough. I'm not worthy enough. And the only identity I really had was my grades. It was the nerdiness in me that, you know, was the thing I held on to because it was the one thing no one could take away. How does Leela react to, you know, being in this kind of environment? Is she even aware of it? Are you even aware of it?
Yeah, so she really is now. I mean, I was always aware of it when we moved and aware that it wasn't super multicultural. It doesn't feel racial tensions in Barcelona and Spain in general are not, well, they're different. There is racism there for sure. It's almost like it doesn't feel as intense somehow walking around somewhere like Barcelona. And it's hard to pinpoint, but I would imagine it's because brown and black people are not in positions of power.
Yeah.
And so there is actually nothing really to threaten the status quo.
Mm.
And so Leela is really aware of it. She is aware of her skin color. She tells me that she really loves it now. And, you know, we were talking about body image the other day for another one of my little casual chats. But she's so kind of attuned, I think, to people who are brown or black, that like the other day there were these two women walking kind of in front of us, and both of them had like really long, beautiful braids, the exact same super dark, really beautiful skin color, and the same height. And she clocked them. And I guess, I think if you are a person of color, you always subconsciously clock people around you.
Yeah.
And she sort of ran ahead of me so that she was running almost kind of in front of them, like with just so much like interest to like go and like check them out. And then she came running back to me and I said, like, what was that about? Like, mm-hmm. you know, and she just said, oh, I just was so curious because to see whether they were like twins or do they look like twins or, but she was so captivated by these two women. And it did make me think, oh, I really need you to, I need to bring you to London more often. Like, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really curious, for example, I mean, she hasn't, because my parents live in Kent, we don't come into London that often. Mm. But I am curious to take her to like a big city like Bangalore or Mumbai and just have her be surrounded by brown people. And I'm just going to film it all, just like see how she reacts to that and without almost without trying to like impose my own feelings on it and just let her kind of, you know, react and feel as she wants.
Mm. It's so funny, isn't it? Because I think if that same scenario had happened, say in Mumbai, I'm sure everyone would have been running to see it, exactly. Look at their hair.
Yeah.
I guess it's the novelty or just the lack of exposure, right? The way that I guess we've got exposure in London, but then mm-hmm. we've also got other issues and think like you talk about, as well in the book, which is are you going to pick, you know, exposure to lots of different cultures or are you going to pick a better quality of life? Like, which one is it? Because you can't always have both. When Leela, or if Leela decides to have her own children, what would you say to her? What would you want her to be like when she's a mother? Or if she becomes a mother, and what would you tell her not to do from maybe things that you might have done?
Yeah. I mean, I would hope that because so, you know, my parents were first generation immigrants, and then with each generation, you do get kind of a bit further and further away from the motherland. Mm. I would hope that she would still retain a bit of like her Indian and Bangladeshi heritage, you know, regardless of who she's with, who our partner is, with her kids, so that they're at least conscious of a little bit of it. I guess I would maybe suggest or encourage her to see if she could spend more time with her kids when they were young, because I was working from when she was about 11 months old. Mm. And in a way, I don't kind of really regret it because I didn't really have a choice. Like I was offered this amazing job. My husband had been made redundant like about 6 months before. Neither of us had great prospects in London. So kind of for our family, I did take it. But I do now feel when I look back, I think, oh, I really wish I just had maybe an extra day at home. But then I don't know. Like it's kind of a... It's sort of a regret, but like, I don't know. It's not necessarily that I had like two options and I chose one.
Yeah.
And also I might have then worked less, but then we might have had less money at the end of the month. And that would have had implications of what we did with Leela and our free time. And so it's a really difficult thing, but yeah. I mean, I would hope that she would be kind of open and kind and talk with her kids if she has them.
Are there any mistakes you think you made as a mother that you would like her to not repeat?
Yeah, I guess my kind of the tendency that I have to take on too many things.
Same.
So I like in the beginning I was working and then when Leela was really small, there wasn't a lot of room for much else. When I started writing this book, ironically, writing about motherhood and my relationship with Leela and all of these things, it just sucked up so much of my time because I was still working. And I think I just took too much time away from her, but at an age where she was actually now able to remember it.
Yeah.
So what's happened over the kind of last couple of years of like now, I mean, I'm not, you know, writing or editing anymore. But I think there's still a part of her that is I don't know if clingy is the word, but she just kind of like is much more concerned if I change my plans with her than she is like with my husband, because I think my husband's consistently been there. Mm. He was a primary carer when I was working, when she was young. So I feel like she just feels secure that he'll always be there. But I think there is a bit of her, also because I travel for work, that she's never quite sure if I'm going to like disappear for a week or 2 weeks or... And I think maybe what I would have done now, if I could go back to kind of a couple of years ago, is actually just work at a slower pace and then have, and then make sure that I had more time with her. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like a bit of separation anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what it is. Mm. Yeah.
So the idea to write this book, where did that come from? At what point did you decide you needed to write this?
So I'd wanted to write about that period that I lived in India. I'd wanted to write about it for a long time because it was just so that around the time that we were leaving, or a couple of years before that time, India had kind of opened up to the world. It opened up its trade borders and tech started like flooding into India, and then the country really changed. Mm. So the bit that I was there, like my teenage years from around like 13 to 16, India radically changed after that and has never been the same. So I really wanted to write about that India, my memory, but I could never figure out where it would go. And I think writers sometimes, like, we have these ideas, or maybe like creatives in general, you like, you have an idea, but it's sort of floating around and there's nothing to anchor it. So I kind of just kept this idea and I'd write a few notes and then I'd park it again. And I literally did this for maybe 4 or 5 years and did nothing with it. And then there was one weekend where my husband Shabby and Leela were, I think they were in London visiting her older brother and sister. And it was like really rainy. I was in Barcelona and I remember thinking, I might just like bring those chapters out again, like a couple of, I'd hardly written anything, maybe like 20 pages or something. And I just thought I want to bring it out again and just work on it. And as I was working on it, because I was now a mum, there was a whole different dimension to it. And it just kind of suddenly clicked into place where I thought, okay, this is where I can talk about my upbringing and my childhood. Mm. Because now I've got this kind of other framework that it connects with, which is me as a mother now.
Yeah.
So it just slotted into place and I wrote like really quickly. But so the idea had kind of come in fragments and then it just needed time, I guess, to bring it all together.
Mm. I mentioned earlier as well, and I kind of want to reiterate this point, that it was very comforting reading this book because you can tell that it's a lifetime of learnings and thought that you've put in, but like very carefully as well. I think we're in a time where people will also publish books as like manifestos for brown girls. I'm sure you've...
That's like a very popular like part of a title, like a manifesto for blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And among all of that, I think is this gem where you just very candidly and honestly speak about your life and the learnings you've had with so much nuance, which I think I want to iterate that because I think... It's not just like any other one of those, you know, it's very much very well written. So I think I really hope that people pick it up because I do think a lot of parents would benefit from it. You know, all mothers all around the world would benefit from thinking about the impact that race has on, you know, being a parent and also even like making decisions to become a parent. I know you speak about a lot of pretty difficult topics in here, and not as like a kind of clickbaity type thing, but actually with a lot of care, which is, you know, things like you know, losing your child or becoming a step parent as well. And I think a lot of those themes are just not really widely, you know, delved into in a lot of detail. So yeah, I think it's quite inspiring. I don't know if you realize it is.
Oh, thank you.
But I do think that I'm going to pick this book up again in a few years' time.
Yeah.
If and when I decide to want a kid of my own. But I just wanted to kind of, I guess, wrap up this conversation by asking you a last question, Priya, which is, what do you have strong game in?
I was thinking about this. What do I have strong game in? I'd say I have strong game in like making life fun with my kid and with my husband. I think like as a family, we really try and prioritize like time together and just, but also just having fun with each other, because I feel like when you have a small kid, it can feel very, can feel like this endless like checklist of like this to do, uniform to wash and blah, 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 blah. But actually, life is like super unpredictable and you don't actually know which way it's going to go from day to day. And so, yeah, and this, I think this is also something that I've picked up from my husband. Like we just try and make things as fun and entertaining and just not boring as possible.
And light as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There should be lightness because there is so much darkness in the world.
Yeah.
That like as much lightness and joy and happiness you can embrace in your day to day, I just think that's the secret to like, to kind of just having a happy life.
Yeah, well, it sounds like Leela's very lucky to have you both as parents, providing that balance maybe between, you know, being also being aware of the things that happen around the world, but keeping things fun where need be. Final thing I'll ask you is, if anyone is thinking about maybe having a kid and is really aware and acutely aware of, you know, all the different things that that brings, what they're going to teach their child, what is a very simple, maybe baby step that you would tell them to look into?
I think what could really help is something that I did when I had a session with a life coach, and she got me to write down the things that were really important. She said, just grab a piece of paper and write down, like, don't think about work or health or any particular aspect. Just write down as a human being what's important to you. Like, is it having, for me, it was like having a meaningful life, doing things that brought meaning. For other people, it could be things that are kind of globally recognized. Or so I would say just thinking about like you as a person and what's important to you, because those are the things that you're going to want to pass on to your kid. And that's how you're going to want to raise your kid. And actually what's important to you will inevitably be what's important to your kid initially, because they kind of become a bit of a mirror image of you. So yeah, just kind of like tapping into your own values and the things that you really believe in, because everyone has a view, right? Everyone has a view on what you should do and how you should raise kids, or, you know, what you teach them, what you don't. But ultimately, if you're the parent, you're their universe. And so you just have to be true to what you genuinely, authentically believe.
I think that's a great place to wrap it up for today. But I just wanted to thank you again, Priya, for coming all the way from Spain.
Yeah. Oh, it's a pleasure.
And I wish you all the best in, you know, putting this book out there. I really hope people pick it up and read it. I think it's a very important book to read, and very digestible as well, because there's really heavy literature and content out there sometimes when it comes to race and identity.
Yeah.
And yeah, for whatever else you go on to write and all the work that you're doing, I wish you all the success for it. And I hope more people kind of get to hear you speak and learn from you.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you.